We're getting new details this afternoon about the deadly attack on Minnesota lawmakers. Police say the suspect, Vance Belter, had notebooks with the names of other lawmakers in them.
And Belter is behind bars right now, facing state and federal charges. Jen Sullivan reports.
As police work to piece together a motive for Saturday's targeted attack against Minnesota lawmakers, we're learning new details about what authorities say was a brazen plan to hunt down a long list of elected officials.
It is no exaggeration to say that his crimes are the stuff of nightmares.
After a 43-hour manhunt, police arrested 57-year-old Vance Belter. He's charged with shooting and killing Democratic Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark inside their Brooklyn Park home early Saturday morning.
It's such a loss, not just for people who knew her, but for the whole state of Minnesota.
Their children, Sophie and Colin Hortman, releasing a statement saying in part, "They were the bright lights at the center of our lives, and we can't believe they are gone. Their love for us was boundless. We miss them so much." Belter is also charged with shooting and seriously injuring Democratic State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette. Police now say Belter went to the homes of two other lawmakers that night, disguised as a police officer. Prosecutors allege he had a long list of intended targets, including some congressional leaders from Michigan.
It's truly chilling.
A longtime friend of Belter's told CNN he was a conservative who strongly opposed abortion rights, but never mentioned any anger with lawmakers who were shot. Other lawmakers on the list speaking out against the political violence.
All of us, every single one of us, has to help dial down the level of rhetoric. We are normalizing violence.
Jen Sullivan, 5 on your side.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. You're going to hear... You already know this story because this happened, what, I don't know, a week ago, 10 days ago? We've had a few events between then and now, like the bombing of Iran. And so this has really gone by the wayside, the story of Vance Luther Belter. But I want to track back with it because it's still an ongoing important story. This is a huge story. It is so bizarre. It's so bizarre. And today we're going to talk to Joseph Hanneman, the investigative reporter with The Blaze, who's been following it and will bring us up to date with some of the bizarre details. But first, well, on June the 24th, which is in or around this date that I'm talking to you, that would be 3 years since Roe versus Wade was overturned. I can hardly believe that. But here's what you might not know. Abortion numbers have surged now to a 10-year high. The battleground has now shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence, often alone. Preborn network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now lie lifeless. 11% of these women who take the pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother too. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued, with your help, could I just say, already rescued over 350,000 babies. But there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. And make your most generous donation. Well, this is Sandy Rios at Sandy Rios 24/7. You can call us if you have a comment on anything you're hearing me say, because I say a lot of controversial things, and I always enjoy your feedback. Call us at 662-821-2040. That's a line that you can leave a message on. I wish it were live radio and we could interact, but it still is wonderful to hear your voice and your response, and we try to use as many of these on the air as we can. You can write at sandy@afr.net, sandy@afr.net. We like to use those on the air as well. You can find us on, yes, Facebook, but Twitter and Instagram and Truth Social and YouTube and Telegram and others. We are there, Sandy Rios, 24/7. You can listen to Sandy Rios 24/7 on any podcast platform at afr.net, AmericanFamilyRadio.net, or you can go to, you know, Spotify or Amazon, whatever is your, or Apple, whatever is your favorite. Or if you're not podcast familiar, go to sandyrios.com. I think that's easy. You can remember my name. Most of you have listened for a while. Just go to sandyrios.com and the daily podcast pop right up. So I think that'll work for you. Let me know if it doesn't. Well, all right, today you're in for, well, I don't think it's a treat. I think it's a like a puzzle. If you like puzzles, you should stay tuned for today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness. That we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice. Not social justice, but God's justice. What's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up. Speak up. Say something. Do something.
The big question for everyone is, what would lead someone to do this? You know, what in their life might spark them to go on this violent rampage? And while we don't have the answers to that question right now, we are learning more about what was happening in Vance Belter's life leading up to this attack. So I've spent the day going over his educational history and also his work history. I learned that he was dealing with some financial issues in the years and months ahead of this attack. He told the court on Monday that he can't afford an attorney. So he quit his job in corporate America. He had worked sort of in the food industry for the majority of his career. 3 years ago, he quit that job and tried to get this security company off the ground. He was taking frequent trips to the Democratic Republic of Congo, trying to set up companies there. But also while he was there, he was giving sermons to churches, to crowds of people there. And he spoke about transgender people and also about abortion during some of those sermons. And we have a clip of that that we'd like to play for you now.
The churches are so messed up.
Les églises sont vraiment un désastre.
They don't know abortion is wrong, many churches. Especially in America.
Il y a des gens, particulièrement aux États-Unis.
They don't know what sex they are. They don't know how their sexual orientation. They're confused.
So he certainly found an audience there in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There are many videos of his sermons online that were published by that church. Karen.
All right. So that's Fox 8 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And that's, let's see, Vance Luther Belter is a Christian, pro-life. He just had financial problems. He was having financial problems. And that's the reason, it seems, the inference, why he went on a shooting spree and killed two people and tried to kill, something like four or six others. We talked about the details of that in the opening of the show, and you are, I think it's important that we be reminded, because this story, because of the events that have eclipsed them, rightfully so, has gone silent. And I think it's important that we learn who Vance Luther Belter is. And so I can't, Joseph Hanneman, our favorite reporter, investigative reporter with The Blaze, has been on this. And I asked him to join me this morning. Joe, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know what, that before we get into Belter, that report reminds me, I was sitting in my living room in Washington, D.C., Joe, when the shooter of the Republicans in the baseball game in Alexandria, Virginia, took place. And my husband was still active duty FBI, and we both were sitting there when an FBI agent, I guess from Alexandria or that area, came out and made some statement that this guy was depressed. He was, upset, kind of a mental health issues, nothing to see here. That's what I'm hearing reminds me about Vance Luther Belter. I'd just like your thoughts on how it's being reported.
Well, you know, we really don't know what his motivation was. This story is so bizarre. It is honestly one of the most bizarre crimes I have ever covered, across 40 years in my career. It there is nothing that jumps out other than he has a very unusual background. You know, that summary that we just listened to does have some of the facts from his background. But, you know, he really was trying to do a whole lot of things. He stopped his corporate career in working for food processing companies like Gerber and Del Monte. And so he left that and was trying to start up a security company, you know, corporate and residential security, armed guards type of a thing. And I'm guessing that's where he got all the equipment when he wore this disguise and went on this murderous rampage on the 14th. He was dressed as a police officer. He had body armor on. He had a tactical flashlight. And he drove what looked like a squad car. It was a Ford SUV, painted and kitted out like a patrol car. And he had the light bars on top, you know, the cherries and berries. And he pulled into the driveways or, you know, on the curb of the street with the emergency lights on. This was at 2 o'clock in the morning and started pounding on the door at the first stop and said, "This is the police, open up." And they looked out, and they didn't see Vance Belter. They saw a man with a silicone mask over his entire head. It's one of these, what they call them, hyper-realistic masks. And he looks incredibly creepy.
Yes,
it's literally something out of a nightmare or out of a horror film. And you know, the state senator that John Hoffman that opened the door then had to face this fella and started saying, you know, he started giving them an excuse why he was knocking on their door, and the senator's wife was looking at this mask and thinking, "Wait a minute, this doesn't look right." And she accused him, "You're not a police officer." And then he said, "Well, this is a robbery." And so here these two people tried to push him back out of the door, and he opened fire on them, and he pumped 17 bullets into the two of them. And the mother, Yvette, she dove over her daughter and covered her so she wouldn't get shot. And she took 8 bullets, and the state senator took 9 bullets. And they survived, which strikes me as an absolute miracle.
I think so, too.
So, I mean, close-range firing, and he actually also shot some of those through the door when they were trying to close the door on him. He fired through their front door,
wow,
which looked like it was made out of steel. And it's just incredible. After he did that, I mean, he had 4 targets, according to the FBI. He had 4 targets for that night that he was ostensibly going to kill them all. He went from the first scene where he shot the senator and his wife, and then went to a state representative's home. And again, with the emergency lights on, a squad car pounding on the door saying, "This is the police, let me in, open up." Well, that state representative apparently had changed her family's plans at the last minute. They were not home, which is, again, she called that providence, and I think she's probably right,
yes,
because their entire family would have been there. So he did not get any response. He figured out there was no one there. Then he moved on to the third one, a state senator from Minnesota, and he parked this squad car, this fake police car, about a block away. I think he was just watching. And by this time, of course, the police radio was crackling all over the area with warnings about this shooting. And a squad car pulled up next to him from this New Hope, Minnesota, and was trying to get his attention. And this officer said he just stared straight ahead. He had this mask on still. He didn't acknowledge. He just stared straight ahead, which you would think would be a very suspicious thing to do. Well, the officer continued driving towards the state senator's home. They were going to do a welfare check. They were going to any of the legislators in the area, police departments were checking on. So she let him sit there, and she called for backup, and by the time the backup got to the senator's house, he left the area. He slipped away, and he went on to his fourth stop, and that's where he murdered the former House Speaker, Minnesota House Speaker, Melissa Hortman, and her husband, Mark.
And her husband.
And their golden retriever, Gilbert. Oh. He murdered the dog, too.
Oh.
What's so strange is that at the Hortman's home, he was on the porch, and Brooklyn Park Police Department was just pulling up a couple of squad cars, again, being proactive and doing a welfare check. And the officers got out of their squad, and he opened fire on them, and then he immediately turned and forced his way into the home, and Melissa Hortman was right inside the door, and he shot her to death and then shot the husband. And, you know, and then, the dog actually survived for a short amount of time. They had to put the dog down because of the severe injuries. And then he started pulling off his disguise, and he ran out the back door. And he got away. And that's where this entire thing began. It led to the largest police manhunt in Minnesota history over the next 37 hours or so.
Yeah. Well, let's come back then to when they captured him and all that. But I just want to, I don't expect you to respond to each thing I'm going to say here, but I just want to lay out the conundrum, one of the many. First of all, you know, they say he's a pastor. New York Post actually reported that he was a militant or a radical. Can't remember what adjective they use, Christian. Oh, he's a Christian. He's a pro-lifer. And yet he was hired by Waltz, Governor Waltz, who was the most radical pro-abortion governor probably in the United States. He was photographed, by the way. I don't know if you saw this, Joe. I've seen it, and I could not. It was from Facebook, and I couldn't send it because I didn't know how. But he was photographed wearing a T-shirt at a resistance rally with another Democrat. So they're leading us to believe he's a conservative, pro-life person. He was married with, what, five kids? They keep talking about he was a father of five, and yet he had a roommate, a male roommate. And then in another report, he's paying for seven cars. And then his kids, his wife and kids are apprehended in a car, all with passports, right after the shooting to get out of the country. His manifesto is secret. I could go on and on, but it's just not simple. I wanted to underscore what you said. So you've been investigating this man, and you've written a couple of articles on it. And so what can you tell us, Joe, about his background, even his upbringing? Anything interesting about that worth sharing?
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges with this case is there's been a lot of misinformation floating around. The thing that you referenced about the resistance and the T-shirt, that was not him. Somebody floated that on X, and James Woods shared it, and somebody determined who that was. It was not him. So somebody kind of looked like him. But, you know, this. And what you had was there was a mad scramble to see who can we blame for this? And, of course, the left was looking for evidence that he was a Trump supporter. And, of course,
and a Christian.
To the right of center were trying to figure out just how much of a Democrat he was, because he indeed was appointed by two successive Minnesota Democratic governors, Mark Dayton and Tim Walz, to a workforce development panel. You know, like one of these advisory groups. And typically you have to be recommended for something like this. You know, we don't have any evidence that he personally knew either of those governors. But so now you've got these dueling facts back and forth and a lot of misinformation. We had a paper in Oklahoma where he had lived at one point claiming he was a registered Republican in 2004 when he lived there. Well, they don't keep records that far back. So the two papers that reported that, I don't know if they just made it up. But, you know, I in fact, this is in the story that I have coming out today that talks about that, in saying that, you know, his voter registration from 2004 does not exist. So whatever it said at the time, under state law, they destroy those after 6 years when you're an inactive voter. So, it's,
well, Joe, is he registered as any party currently?
Well, Minnesota, like Wisconsin, is an open primary state, so mm-hmm. they don't ask that, and you do not declare your party affiliation. So in Minnesota, you know, if he's registered, it's not going to say a party. So, you know, that's the one of the difficulties in using that is the lens. And I don't think when this is all said and done, we're going to find it's that simple. He did appear to be pro-life. I think he considered himself a preacher. He claimed he was ordained, although where, I don't know. He did attend a Christ for the Nations college, school, seminary. I'm not sure exactly how they describe themselves, but in Dallas, and kind of pastoral leadership courses, and he did attain a diploma there. So he considered himself Christian, and as you heard in the one of the sermons he gave at this evangelical church in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, you know, he talked about some of the current social issues that we all face, you know, from transgenderism to abortion.
Joe, let me interject on that, because I did listen to that, and I think there are some other clips that I'd like to listen to of him preaching. And, because I am a Christian, and, you know, I have a nose that sniffs things out about that, for sure. That was odd. That was just very odd. It just didn't seem right. It's almost like he's either crazy or that's a cover for his international travels. I don't know. But that's the thing that went through my mind. So that's not scientific. It's just my nose sniffing. But, okay, so he did go to a Bible college. I did read that. And but his travels, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting your narrative, but his travels are strange, aren't they? They're not just mission trips to, Dominican Republic or wherever that was. They're strange.
Yeah, shortly after he was arrested, the Oversight Project, which used to be part of Heritage Foundation, they did a geofencing analysis of phones that reside or move about in the area where he lives in Minnesota. And they found what they call a unique device. I think the implication was this was very likely his cell phone. And they tracked it using ad IDs. This is what apps that reside on your phone utilize technology, and they ping locations and send them back to the advertisers. And you're able to purchase this data. So Oversight Project looked back 3 years, and they said that this phone pinged in, of course, many spots around the Twin Cities, but also in Turkey, in India, Nepal, Dubai.
They said, though, the West Bank and Gaza.
That was something he reported.
Okay.
On one of the websites for some of these self-started businesses that he worked on, he said prior to 9/11 that he had gone, you know, to evangelize and gone to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and he was trying to minister to radical Islamists and tell them, as he put it, that violence isn't the answer. Now, I don't know that I believe that story. In fact, we talked to Robert Spencer from Jihad Watch, and he said if he really did that, he would have been killed or taken hostage unless the radical Islamists he said he was approaching saw him as a fool and they cut him a break. But he said, you don't proselytizing in Islam, is a capital crime. So I think this fella has a pretty active imagination. We don't know that he actually took all these trips because I don't know when he would have worked. This was at the time he was ostensibly working for all these food manufacturers in different states around the country. So they are still investigating that to try to find more information on his phone to see if there are patterns or if they intersect with other people from the area. Because
so
we do know he took missionary trips, because some of the trips to Congo were missionary trips that were organized by a group in Minnesota. But he also went to that country for business. He was trying to set up call it farm-to-fork food system, because they import most of their food in Congo. And given his background, he thought this could be a business opportunity. So he's been over there multiple times for that. I imagine that was probably fairly expensive, and you know, you heard the commentary about financial problems, which
yes.
I have no doubt that's true, because I don't think his only regular income was some work for part-time work for some funeral homes. So he was hauling dead bodies for funeral homes to try to pay the bills while he's doing all this other stuff.
Yeah. And Joe, excuse me for interrupting. There's a girl, we heard her already talk about that. She's asked the question, what could lead to someone doing this? And then she talks about how difficult times. And then she reports on his finances. And I think let's interject this for a second, because I think it's appropriate. This is clip 4.
It appears that he owns his home. He told the court that when I was there on Monday, he told the court that he owns his home free and clear, but he's also paying for 7 vehicles. So he did seem to indicate that he's dealing with somewhat of a tough financial situation. That roommate that you mentioned, David Carlson, when I spoke with him on Saturday, he also indicated that Vance was going through some financial issues and there was a lot of stress surrounding that. The court did say before appointing him a public defender, they will do sort of a forensic deep dive on his financial situation to make sure that he can't afford an attorney. So we should learn more about that at the next court hearing.
Okay, so Joe, he's 7 cars. He's paying for 7 cars. And he supposedly has 5 children. He's a father of 5, they kept telling us, father of 5. But he lives with a roommate. And he has, what, a leased like apartment where he had an extra SUV hanging out? I don't know. I know I'm throwing things at you, but those things are just weird. They don't add up.
Well, some of those 7, and I don't know how many, would have been for this security company he was trying to start up. These are Ford SUVs that you see in just about any police department in the country. So I don't know of that 7 how many were those police vehicles, but I've got pictures of some of these. They basically are squad cars and customized to look like police vehicles. So I'm sure part of that 7 is related to his security company, which I don't think ever got off the ground. You know, we found the website for it was, if it was live at all, it was only for a matter of weeks. We were able to find it using the Internet Archive and look at the information on there, but he has no experience in security. He didn't work in law enforcement or military, but he was trying to start up this Praetorian Guard Security Services.
But so how do we then explain his expertise with a firearm? Because you know, you can, even if you don't have much experience, you could shoot even at close range. Or well, I don't know. I suppose he did shoot at close range, but he seemed to have great facility with a firearm and pretty determined, like he understood military tactics and all of that. So where did he get that?
And he did write on one of his websites that he was trained by private security and U.S. military. So,
okay,
and again, we're trying to parse through all of these statements to find out how much of this is actually true and how much, if any, was made up. Now, the military training, I think, becomes even more interesting, considering he left a letter in one of the vehicles he used to escape, and it was addressed to Kash Patel, the director of the FBI. And in that letter, he blamed Governor Walz of Minnesota for the shooting rampage. He claimed in this letter that Governor Walz told him to kill Senator Amy Klobuchar so the governor could run for U.S. Senate, and that the governor also told him to kill others. And I don't know if specifically the four that he targeted that night, but that news just broke this past Friday night. Just absolutely strange. They have not released the letter. A couple of media outlets had some sources who had read it and seen it, so we don't know the full context of that. But he came out and blamed Governor Walz and said basically this was his idea. So it just keeps getting stranger by the day.
It really does. Now, I have another report here that makes comments on the notes that were found. So let's just listen to that. That's clip 7.
You heard officials really clarifying the notes, the idea that he had some manifesto. They said, no, the why of this, why he acted in this way is not clear at this point, but that through a search of his vehicle, a search of his home, they recovered extensive notes that they say were taken over the course of years, months, and included numerous names of state elected officials, federal elected officials, and even some abortion rights activists. So they're saying that there's no real sense of why he did this, or why he took these steps, but that's definitely a focus of the investigation, and clearly the chilling details that they just explained to us in that account that they gave, it really sends shivers up your spine when you know how much planning went into this, according to those federal authorities, Kate.
Okay, Joe, so you've talked, that a letter to Kash Patel, I guess, was a recent find, as you mentioned. But before that, they claim there's a manifesto and a list of, I think it was 50-something people, allegedly, that they think he wanted to kill. Why, what more do you know about that?
Well, I suspect that what they described, or I should say the media described early on as a manifesto, probably referred to the letter that was left in the vehicle, which was within a couple of miles of where he was eventually arrested. But he also had notebooks that were full of notations, and that relates to he researched these potential victims, including Melissa Ortman, and he researched their residences, who might live there, how to get there, what roads would be the best routes out to escape. So he basically, and he's charged federally with stalking. So, you know, he basically, at least electronically, stalked his victims and did, it looked like, painstaking research. And they found notes like this in the squad car, his fake squad car, which was left in the driveway of Melissa Hortman and her husband. And they also found some of these notes in a room that he rented in North Minneapolis. Because he was working a lot of night hours, he sublet a room from a friend of his that is from his hometown. And that's the roommate that they were talking about. So a few nights a week he would basically crash there after working a shift, or sometimes he was on call. You know, in the funeral business, a lot of times he'll get calls out in the middle of the night. So that's why he had a room in this house with his friend, okay, David Carlson. But
well, what do we know about the family being apprehended with all the passports? That's also gone quiet. I mean, what do we know about that? Do we know where they were going, where they are now? Anything?
Yes. The murders that took place happened about 3:30 in the morning. And at around 6:15, he was seen on security cameras back at this home in North Minneapolis where he rents a room. And he started a group text with his family, with his children and his wife. And in that, he told them that last night, Dad went to war. And then he said, there's going to be police coming to the house, and they're going to be trigger happy, and I don't want you to be there. And then after typing that, he either called or texted his wife just privately, and said he was so sorry for all of this situation, as he put it. But he encouraged her to take the children and go somewhere, and she did. She withdrew $10,000 from a bank. She took passports. She had a firearm and ammunition, and piled the children in a car, and they headed north. And, of course, she had her phone with her, and police were tracking her the whole time. And when she stopped, I believe, at a convenience store, this was probably about 80 miles north of where the crime scene was, a SWAT team came up and detained her, and that's when they searched the car and they found all of these things that, you know, we don't know exactly what her plans were, if she had any knowledge of this stuff. She has not been charged, so I'm thinking at this point that she didn't know about this stuff, but that's how they found, you know, the cash and the weapons, and, you know, she was driving to get away because, of course, as he predicted, SWAT team showed up at their home in Green Isle, Minnesota, and searched the place, I'm sure tore it apart looking for evidence.
Well, okay, so on another note, I've heard a lot of speculation about why he chose Melissa and John Hartman and John and Eric Yvette Hoffman. But I want to know what you think. What do you think is the reason he chose them, as far as we can know?
I honestly, with all his background, do not see a clear motive. This was not, by any measure I could find, a political man. We did not find any campaign donations. We checked FEC, Federal Election Commission records. We checked Minnesota state campaign records and found no donations in any of those records. Now, typically, if you're real heavily involved in politics, that would be a natural thing to do. So, you know, and the roommate, David Carlson, said that he wasn't interested in state or local politics. This was not something that he followed all that often. So, you know, the one thing about the Melissa Hortman, who had been the Speaker of the Minnesota House of Representatives, she crossed party lines, and this was within 10 days before the shooting, and she voted with the Republicans to strip the illegal aliens in Minnesota, the adults, from subsidized or free health care. And that made quite a bit of news that she was the only one of her party to cross the line on that. there was a lot of speculation initially from the right that, the Democrats took her out because she denied the illegal aliens their health care. I don't think that's the case, but it, you know, it's certainly something that you have to look at. But, you know, the former speaker, she was also, it's very interesting, she was a Catholic, and yet she led the legislative charge to enshrine what they call so-called abortion rights into state law, and in the 2023 Minnesota legislative session. So it's, you know, that's a conflict. You can't be a Christian and promote abortion. It just, it doesn't work. So, you know, that there could have been something related to that. You know, we don't know, because he did not, as far as I know, on any of these documents they found, analyze the people or say, you know, that what he thought of what they had done. He did list some of the Planned Parenthood locations around Minnesota and some of the board members. And again, this, they called this a hit list, and it had more than 50 names on it in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, and now Texas. That popped up in the last couple of days, a couple of Texas lawmakers. And these, I believe, were all Democrats. So, you know, clearly he had some agenda. But, you know, it's this picture is as clear as mud right now. And, you know, the FBI and federal prosecutors have not released any more than what was in the charging documents. And there was a lot in there. It was a 22-page affidavit from the FBI that detailed this entire story and his path from shooting these people to when he was caught in the field, which was only about a mile from his home.
Yeah, that was all. That was bizarre, too. I think they said he was crawling. And here's the thing. Joe, just to confirm what you said, so I'll make sure I get this right. Whatever manifesto and writings he had, you think we have the list of people and the letter to Cash. If I would not think under Cash, because they're trying so hard, they are really making a great effort to be transparent. I would not think the FBI would withhold information that they could release, but I don't trust the Minneapolis police, so I don't know what you think about that. Do you think it's possible that the Minneapolis police could withhold other things and the FBI, you know what I'm asking. Could there be more information that they're misleading us with?
The FBI, as they often do in situations like this, they basically took over this case. This is ostensibly a state crime. You're talking about murder and attempted murder. But because the firearms that were used, oftentimes they have parts that cross state lines. Say you bought a magazine for your gun and it shipped from a different state. Well, that gives the FBI the impetus to come in and charge you with an interstate crime. And that's what happened in this case. I don't know that the law enforcement ever called it a manifesto, but like I said, I'm pretty sure that refers to the letter. They refused to give copies of that out. They were asked at press conferences to provide that to reporters, and they said they would not do that. And now, after learning what it says, that he blamed Governor Walz and said, Governor Walz told me to shoot U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar. I suspect that's why they withheld it, because it's just a wild, almost unbelievable accusation. But as far as I know, there are not other documents. He didn't write a political screed, and you know, a document like that might have offered some clues. But this was what they found were just surveillance notes, stalker's notes, and then this handwritten letter that he left for the FBI. I hope they do release that. I think it's incumbent upon them to do it, because people need to understand what created this man, because this was an incredibly evil act and done with great foresight and planning, and was not just to kill these people, but to terrorize them, this mask he wore. And the security video showing him standing at the state senator's door, this bald mask, he just looks like a monster in a police uniform.
Yeah.
And
it's
that
true.
That goes to terror. He wanted to see the fear on their faces when they realized he was not only not a police officer, he was there to shoot him. Yeah. And I'm sure the senator and his wife, probably when they realize that, it just makes you shudder. It really does.
Yes, because it seems so random now. After we've talked, it really does seem so random. But listen, Joe, I really appreciate, first of all, I love your reporting, and I appreciate you joining us to tell us what you're discovering. So I'm going to have to rein in my own wild theories in my head and line it up with the truth that you, or the facts that you have so far. And I want to say Joe's got some, he's got two, three now, articles, I believe, on at the Blaze. And by the way, the Blaze is one of the best sources of information right now. We have a million outlets to choose from, but I think the Blaze is just really spectacular. They're covering all kinds of things and a lot of things that no one else is covering. So I commend them to you. I pay for it. It's not that much. And I think it's worth what I pay. So I'm just telling you. But the articles are: accused assassin Vance Bolter blames Governor Tim Walz for a murderous rampage. And also the phone story about what oversight project. That's our friend Mike Howell, who's my guest here often. It runs this oversight project. So what they've discovered about this phone. And then the third one that's coming out today. Right, Joe?
Actually, I've probably got six or seven articles. If you go to the Blaze, you'll see one. It may have posted while we're speaking, but there's six or seven articles I've written about this since the 14th.
Okay. Oh, good. Well, you know what? We have to do this. We have to stay at this because we can't. We got to get down to the guts of the wickedness. I think we know, both you and I know what that wickedness is, but we have to do something about it. We have to apply pressure. Bring punishment. It has to stop as best we can stop it. So, Joe Hanneman, again, investigative reporter for The Blaze. Joe, thanks so much. We appreciate you joining us.
Happy to come anytime.
All right, Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. Hi, this is Sandy Rios. A lot of Christians would be shocked to learn they are personally profiting from abortion and pornography. It's unnerving to realize just how many companies and corporations are actively involved in unbiblical practices. To help cut through the red tape, there is a great option known as Timothy Plan. Timothy Plan is the pioneer in biblically responsible investing. Timothy Plan carefully filters out companies involved in practices Scripture tells us to avoid. We are in an all-out culture war. One powerful way to make a difference is to put our money where our values are. Please go to timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-846-7526. Discover how to be a biblically responsible investor.
Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the investment company. This and other important information can be found in the fund's prospectus. To obtain a copy, visit timothyplan.com or call 800-846-7526. Read each prospectus carefully before investing.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
The FDA finally approved the French abortion pill, and again, there's two pills. They okayed the first one, mifepristone, for chemical abortions up to 7 weeks. Later, that was extended to 10 weeks under Barack Obama. And then under Joe Biden, they opened the door to the FDA approving of mifepristone prescriptions online, through the mail, and without any kind of supervision. And the Supreme Court upheld that unanimous ruling just in 2024. It really is despicable. I'm telling you, it is despicable, given the number of injuries, 10% or so of women who have these chemical abortions, not to mention the loss of life, the trauma of delivering at home. It is a disgraceful thing that our country has done. But Preborn is trying to provide a redemptive way to stop it. They have a pill that can actually reverse that first pill, and the first one is mifepristone. So if a mother has second thoughts when she takes that first pill, if she gets to a Preborn clinic, they can stop that. But if she takes the second pill, which expels the baby, it's too late. And that's why we're trying to educate women, not educate. I hate that. Just really too sterile. We're trying to move their hearts by showing them their baby in utero through ultrasound. That's what Preborn does. That's the emotional trigger, which is genuine and real from the heart of God. That's a baby. And when women see that, they don't take these abortion pills. It stops it before it begins. But both things have to be addressed, and that's what Preborn does. If you would like to help, it's $28 for one ultrasound. Just go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. And please make your most generous donation.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Well, it's not just the killings that happened in Minnesota. There are other congressmen, federal and state, who have been attacked recently. It's really getting frightening for them. In fact, in, I believe it's Ohio, Congressman Max Miller had a situation. He describes it in this clip, clip one.
Let's make something abundantly clear to anyone who needs to see this, which apparently is a lot of people. If you have an issue with a legislator, your city councilman, your mayor, anyone like that, the appropriate thing to do is to reach out to them for a phone call to set up a meeting at one of our district offices. What is not okay is to assault anyone, whether you're a member of Congress or anybody else within our district, while you are driving to work. Ohio 7, this morning, as I was driving to work, some unhinged, deranged man decided to lay on his horn and run me off the road when he couldn't get my attention to show me a Palestinian flag. Not to mention death to Israel, death to me, that he wanted to kill me and my family. Thank God my daughter was not in my vehicle or anybody else at the time. We know exactly who you are. I have gone about my day. I have carried on my meetings, and we will not hide. And I will continue to fight against anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and all other forms of hate. You have an issue? Take it to our office. You want to run me off the road? That's a different story. We know who you are, young man, and the police are going to be paying you a visit. And I hope what you did this morning is worth it to you and anyone else who plans on doing this to anybody within our district, state, or country.
All right, Max Miller, I think from Ohio Congressman, and he said it well. I don't need to add anything to that. On the issue of Vance Lutherbelcher, I just want to make something clear. Do I need to make this clear? A person cannot be a follower of Jesus Christ and believe life is sacred. Because God says the life is in the blood. We don't shed any other person's blood. We don't randomly do acts of violence. It's not compatible, a Christian pastor who believes in life, with someone who dons a death mask and brutally murders people in cold blood with the intent to murder many, many more. There's something terribly wrong here. And I just hope when you hear I hate that they label him as a Christian. And I hate that that's in his background because we have to explain. But you know what? We do have to explain, so don't fail to do it. Just that a Christian who professes to be pro-life does not go around murdering people. It's a little bit of a contradiction. So I'll leave with that today. We have to stop it. And, of course, we have a spiritual problem in our country, and we have to confront that too. So we're working on it. And I want to thank you for listening. And before I say goodbye to you, Timothy, Plan is one of our sponsors, and they show you how to put your money where your values are and discover how to be a biblically responsible investor. Visit timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy, or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-TIM-PLAN. Well, thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.